Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Sea Control Podcast, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security. My name is Matthew Marighi, and I'm your host for Sea Control North America. Today, we will be speaking with Professor Sung-Yun Lee of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy to discuss North Korea, its strategic ambitions, and how the United States should respond. We'll get started with this thought-provoking interview in just a few minutes.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SIMSEC is and always will be free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There is a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SIMSEC article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SIMSEC is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today!
And we're back. As I mentioned, I'm here with Professor Sung-Yun Lee of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy to talk about North Korea, Korean Peninsula politics, and the general workings of East Asia. Professor Lee, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Please, as is tradition, tell us a little bit about yourself, what your background is, where you're coming from, and what brought you to study the topics we're going to talk about today.
So I was born in Seoul, South Korea. I've lived the past 30 years or so in the United States. I've been educated in the U.S., I remain a South Korean citizen, and I came to take interest in North Korea about 15 years ago, primarily through the prism of human rights. As an ethnic Korean, as a Korean national, the more I learned about the egregious human rights violations by the North Korean regime against the vast majority of the people, the more interested I became in this very unique, peculiar country and regime called North Korea. And the more I studied about North Korea's strategy of provocations, its desire to become a nuclear power, to build a credible nuclear arsenal, and one day try to combine a nuclear-tipped warhead with a long-range missile and demonstrate its capacity to be a lethal threat to the United States, continental U.S., the more I became worried that the U.S. and South Korea and Japan and others in the region are not really doing all that much to derail North Korea from that destructive course. I think North Korea is the only country in the region that is not satisfied with the status quo, and North Korea's interlocutors are pretty much happy to go along and maintain the status quo, meaning prevent the collapse of the DPRK, meaning not really take risks to put real pressure on the North Korean regime to deter its growing lethality. So these are some of the issues related to North Korea that I'm interested in and that I've been studying for the past dozen years or so.
So when you decided to start studying this topic, you know, to do it formally and to do it in an academic setting, what direction then did you go in terms of the institutions that you studied at and the kind of topics or the sources of research that you use? What kind of things did you do in order to further that interest that you mentioned?
Well, in South Korea, you know, I've benefited from proper anti-communist education. And I'm kidding here a little bit. But, you know, people of my generation, the way we were taught is that North Korea is a lethal threat. North Korea is a serious threat to South Korea. It's an existential threat. So perhaps I may be a bit biased in wholeheartedly embracing that view of North Korea as a threat, but I think the world has come to see that North Korea is indeed a threat, not only to South Korea, but to the region and to global U.S. interests. So like others, I came to take interest in North Korea's nuclear policy or North Korea's nuclear extortion policy. And, you know, even going back 20 years ago, more or less, when we had the so-called Geneva Accord between the U.S. and North Korea in 1994. That seemed to, if not solve or resolve the nuclear issue, at least put a cap on North Korea's nuclear weapons development program. I was skeptical because, you know, we have a tendency to sort of patronize North Korea, and the reasons are fairly obvious. They're kind of weird. You know, backward. North Korea is the only country in world history that's taken a major leap backward, you know, for an industrialized country, for an industrialized, urbanized, literate, peacetime economy to undergo a famine as North Korea did in the mid to late 1990s is unprecedented. Always famines happen in pre-industrialized, poor economies where illiteracy is very high, hovering around 25% or even up to 75% in the female population. North Korea did not suffer from any of those disadvantages. North Korea became an industrialized country by the mid-60s, yet fully 5 decades into its statehood, into its existence as a de facto state, North Korea suffered a famine which perhaps claimed 10% of the population. So North Korea is very different. It's unique. So for a country like that, beset by such economic problems, nuclear weapons and the ability to be a factor in the international politics of the region and to get respect from the world's biggest powers like the US, China, Russia, Japan, and South Korea, to sit down to negotiate with these great powers, these rich and big countries, is something that North Korea would probably not easily give up. Not for billions of dollars or tens of billions of dollars or trillions of dollars. Because in the end, economic blandishments expire. You know, they run out. And then what will North Korea do after it gives up its nuclear weapons? Depend on the goodwill of its neighbors? I think that would be very poor national policy. So even 15, 20 years ago, I was very skeptical that North Korea would ever give up its nuclear weapons program. And once North Korea crossed that Rubicon, conducting its first ever nuclear test, which it did in October 2006, in my view, there is just no way we can, through artful diplomacy, persuade North Korea to give up its nuclear arsenal, simply because the history of nuclear weapons development is an unpromising precedent. It sets an unpromising precedent for nuclear negotiations vis-a-vis a nuclear weapons possessing state. No country that had crossed the nuclear threshold has ever given up its existing nuclear arsenal without a change in the leadership, without a new leadership emerging. And the only instances of states that had acquired nuclear weapons and later negotiated them away are the former Soviet republics of Kazakhstan, Ukraine, Belarus, that inherited Soviet nukes in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then South Africa in the late 80s. In each of those 4 cases, you had a new regime collapse, new regime formation, new opportunities, new political environment. And in an attempt to improve their relations with Western Europe and the United States, those countries gave up, you know, nuclear weapons. North Korea is the same family dynasty. It has been for the past 7 decades almost. And North Korea, again, is riddled with all kinds of problems. It faces a far more prosperous and pleasant Korean state across the border. The income economic disparity, the gap between the level of economic conditions in the north and in the south, is probably the highest between any contiguous neighbors by land. You know, between any neighbors, I think you see the greatest income gap between North Korea and South Korea. And the fact that many North Koreans have taken great risks to go over the fence to resettle in the south. Today there are over 27,000 North Korean defectors living in South Korea. You know, that suggests that the North Korean regime faces a long-term existential threat in the sheer existence of a far more successful, attractive Korean state, i.e. South Korea. So my point is, for North Korea, you know, if you apply the conventional indices of measuring state power, military power, economic power, soft power, attractive culture, population size, territorial size, in all these indices, North Korea does not do very well, except for military power. We know North Korea has a huge conventional military, one of the biggest in the world for such a small country. For a population of 24 million, North Korea has over a million men in its army. So that is highly unusual. And North Korea is also armed now, obviously, with nuclear weapons, chemical weapons. So it's a military threat, and we take North Korea seriously, at least the military professionals in the United States and South Korea and other countries take North Korea seriously. But in other branches of the government, in the executive office even, especially among academia, people tend to sort of patronize North Korea. People think North Korea is either bizarre and weird, laughable, a child even, prone to temper tantrum, and we just have to be a bit nice, a bit civil, a bit sophisticated in our approach to North Korea. Sort of pat North Korea on the back like a child, and maybe they'll listen to us. That kind of very simplistic and condescending view really drove, I would say, our policy toward North Korea for many years. And I think a lot of that has been extinguished. That view is no longer the prevailing view in Washington or Seoul or Tokyo today. But it's unfortunate that we still tend to sort of laugh North Korea off. The leader hangs out with controversial, you know, individuals like Dennis Rodman and so forth. They look funny, you know, they're laughable, but it's no joke. North Korea's growing lethality, North Korea's growing lethal threat to the United States, obviously to South Korea, and also its extreme repression of the North Korean population, which, according to a landmark 2014 UN Commission of Inquiry study on human rights in North Korea, says that North Korea's systematic violations of human rights in North Korea against the people is, quote, without parallel in the contemporary world. It's the worst. So these are very serious issues, long-term issues that we have to deal with. And I think just maintaining the status quo, that is preventing war, preventing a major crisis from taking place, and really not doing much to dismantle North Korea's nuclear weapons programs, is not in the long-term interest of the United States, because one day we will see that North Korea is a real nuclear power, nuclear weapon state with the ability to marry a bomb with a long-range missile that can reach and destroy big cities in the United States. And not to suggest North Korea is suicidal, I don't think so. But if North Korea is able to demonstrate that kind of capability and, as it's prone to doing, threaten the United States with nuclear annihilation, threaten to nuke LA or San Francisco on the West Coast, a major city on the West Coast, it does change the equation a little bit, the balance of power. It changes the balance of power in the Korean Peninsula and the relationship between the North Korea and the U.S. It tilts the balance in North Korea's favor, and that means North Korea will probably be better positioned to make all kinds of demands on economic issues, political concessions, and that is not in our interest.
So yeah, I think you've done a very good job at laying out the elements that make up the current policy and why it's not working and what North Korea will be able to do down the road. So if you were kind of king for the day of the five parties of the six-party talks on the other side from North Korea, what then, you know, you mentioned that there needs to be an approach change, but what specific things or specific policies do you think might go a long way towards either standing up to the North Koreans or at the very least trying to divert them away from continued provocations and attempts at coercion? Is it economic sanctions? Is it, you know, force posture increases? Is it more exercises? What things do you think that the rest of the world can do to try to change the status quo in a way that's beneficial to everybody?
Yeah, all of those things that you just mentioned, I would say. There is no single policy that is a silver bullet, but then that's rather elementary. You know, we often hear North Korea is the country of lousy options, there are no simple solutions. Well, there aren't any simple solutions vis-a-vis Russia or Iran or other problematic countries. So, again, this kind of fatalistic view that there's not much we can do against North Korea because they are they will bristle at any military pressure or financial pressure, they may go berserk and lash out at South Korea, is in a twisted way an extension of our tendency to patronize North Korea. North Korea must be crazy or suicidal, so let's not do anything to put real pressure on them. I say hit North Korea where it hurts, and I don't mean military action. North Korea has systemic weaknesses. You know, the regime is rather short on cash. North Korea doesn't produce and sell really competitive goods on the world market. I mean, have you ever owned anything that said made in the DPRK? That was, you know, a very good electronic item or what have you. And it's not only because, you know, the U.S. imports hardly anything from North Korea. It's just that North Korea is not very competitive on the world market. They're very good at making weapons, missiles, and so forth. But, you know, North Korea is rather isolated in that regard. North Korea is also unique in that it is the only country in the world that, as a matter of state policy, produces and sells drugs, illicit substances.
What kind of drugs?
Meth, heroin, what have you. And they've been doing it since the mid-1970s. And this is not your conventional criminal organization that are found in every country in the world doing this. It's a matter of state policy, state-directed production and proliferation of drugs, also fake famous U.S. brand cigarettes like Marlboro, also counterfeiting the $100 bill, U.S. currency. So North Korea is very different, I admit. It is bizarre and unique. But these practices also suggest that there are systemic weaknesses on the part of the North Korean regime that we could focus on. And let me expand on that in a minute. The other systemic weakness, I would say, is, again, North Korea's extreme human rights violations. There is certainly a case for calling out the regime as being perverse, evil even. But I think North Korea engages in this kind of extreme systematic repression, crimes against humanity, against its population, because it really can't afford, it feels it cannot afford to grant basic freedoms to the people. Because once the people in North Korea find out more about the conditions of life in South Korea, outside North Korea, in other countries, in other normal countries, you know, they will probably complain and maybe even confront the regime, come to confront the regime one day. So North Korea keeps information out of North Korea as much as it can. North Korea keeps its population in the dark about the outside world. And North Korea has been very successful as a totalitarian state in controlling the people, in invading their private realm and making all the key decisions in life for the people, the state dictating where you live, what kind of work you engage in, what school you go to, and so forth, even what kind of food and how much you can receive, depending on your political classification system. So this is another weakness to be exploited. So I would suggest a two-pronged strategy. First, and probably more important, is targeted financial measures, targeted financial sanctions against North Korea's illicit streams of revenue. And to complement that, a sustained human rights propaganda campaign, disseminating information, transmitting information into North Korea so that the people are piqued and perhaps even inspired to do something about this repressive regime and their very sorry lives. And these are not lethal means. These are conventional tools of even diplomacy. You know, you use economic pressure, you use sanctions to try to change regime behavior in that target nation. Sanctions get a bad rap because a lot of people take the view that sanctions are not effective, and oftentimes they hurt more the innocent people rather than the corrupt regime. And certainly there are historical precedents, foundations for that kind of view. But in the case of North Korea and in the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, targeted financial sanctions by the U.S. Treasury Department has really evolved rapidly into sort of a weaponization of finance. It's an entirely different creature from conventional trade sanctions that we associate with the Cold War era, you know, trade embargo. We don't export anything to you. We don't import anything to you. We try to isolate you. But, of course, other countries trade with that target nation, and there is minimum impact. Cuba is Exhibit A in that regard. However, targeted financial sanctions in the post-9/11 era seek to isolate that target from the dollar-denominated international financial order. Meaning, if you designate, if the U.S. Treasury Department designates an individual or a bank or a government agency, or in some cases, as Treasury has, the entire state and the leadership, the top leadership, what that means is any third country party or agency or individual continuing to deal in financial transactions with that targeted entity will also suffer financial losses, will be blocked out of the U.S.-led dollar system. And that is not in your interest. Whether you are just a small businessman with a small company or a major bank or a major government agency, you shy away from that eventuality and you, in the main, cut off financial dealings with that targeted entity. With respect to North Korea, we've seen this before in 2005 and 2006. In September 2005, Treasury designated a small bank in Macau, Banco Delta Asia, primary money laundering concern, and there were about $25 million held in various North Korean accounts in that small bank. All of a sudden, North Korea found itself isolated after that designation and felt really squeezed because North Korea's trade partners, you know, North Korea's partners in financial dealings, shied away from dealing with North Korea, including the Bank of China. No one wants to come under the scrutiny of the Treasury Department. You know, money is a very powerful lever. So when North Korea conducted its third nuclear test in February 2013, Treasury designated a major North Korean bank, North Korea's foreign trade bank, as a key node in North Korea's global proliferation network. And that led to four of China's biggest banks all of a sudden cutting off financial dealings with that North Korean designated bank. Bank of China, the Agricultural Bank of China, the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, and the Construction Bank of China. These four biggest banks in China all of a sudden completely cut off dealings with North Korea. So banks are very conservative. They hate to lose money. So that's a very powerful, powerful tool in the U.S. toolbox that, for some reason, the current administration is not really keen on using. I think this kind of risk aversion, you know, the notion that, yes, North Korea is a gradually growing threat, but it's not an imminent crisis right now, so let's not escalate. Let's shy away from taking any kind of risk that may push North Korea to provoke or launch a small-scale, controlled, limited attack on South Korea because that would make us look bad. I think there is this kind of view that, you know, North Korea is not an imminent threat, so let's just ignore it. Strategic patience, that's the moniker under the current administration's North Korea policy over the past few years. But as senators and congressmen, there's a growing bipartisan criticism of the Obama administration's North Korea policy. As Senator Cory Gardner said just last week in Washington, it is not strategic patience, it's strategic failure. We need to do more. We need to put real pressure on North Korea.
Well, let's talk a little bit. You mentioned or at least alluded to a couple of very specific incidents, I think, that probably have still cast a pall over confronting North Korea too directly, notably the shelling of the island and the sinking of the Cheonan back in, I guess it was the mid-2000s when both of those happened. Mm-hmm. But we haven't seen any other incidents like that since those two. So I'm curious what you think the reasons are behind that from the North Korean side, and then also from kind of the external factors, what do you think has played into that? And then sort of extrapolating outward, you know, regardless of whether, you know, Western powers or countries outside of North Korea pressure it, do you think that another incident like that might happen since they've used it as a coercive tool in the past? And if so, what kind of indicators? Because, you know, as a Stalinist country, essentially we have to do old Sovietology and, you know, sort of triangulating what it is that they might do. So what sort of things do you think people should be on the lookout then for seeing future provocative actions by North Korea?
I take the view, and I realize this is not, you know, a global, universal view, but I take the view that North Korea's provocations are, on the whole, very calculated. They know just how far to push, how to just kind of stab and then take a step back. And I base that view on my study of the past, really, 60 years or so of North Korea's strategic provocations based on what they sought to achieve, what they got in return, how little they were punished, and also based on North Korea's reading of the international environment, that is, was it favorable to the United States, North Korea's biggest adversary, or not? And just to give you quickly a couple of examples, you know, 1968 is a momentous year for the United States because in early 1968, in the aftermath of the Tet Offensive, the Vietnam War became a real political liability for the United States, for the Johnson administration. Not a good time to go all out and punish another communist country in East Asia. And I would say North Korea read that strategic environment very well. So beginning in January of 1968, North Korea takes risks and puts real pressure on the United States and its ally South Korea. There's the commando raid with the express purpose of assassinating the South Korean president, which failed, but 31 highly trained North Korean commandos came into, you know, they were shooting at each other with the South Korean forces on January 21st. 2 days later, on the 23rd of January 1968, North Korea attacked and seized the USS Pueblo, a naval intelligence ship, and held in captivity 82 sailors for an entire, well, almost a year. After 11 months, and only upon an official apology by the Johnson administration for the crime of infiltrating North Korean waters and spying on North Korea, did North Korea release the 82 U.S. sailors. And North Korea really mistreated the sailors, often beating them and torturing them. But the U.S., in the end, you know, made that bogus confession, that concession, admitting its crime, although the Pueblo was seized in international waters, for the sake of, well, the release of the sailors and also for the sake of political expediency. In the meantime, North Korea is sending literally hundreds of commandos into South Korea in order to try to foment a pro-communist uprising. Next year, in 1969, things really don't get any better. We have the new Nixon administration, but early in the Nixon administration, on the occasion of Kim Il-sung's, the North Korean leader's birthday on April 15th, North Korean jets tag and shoot a U.S. spy plane in international airspace, clearly 90 kilometers or more off the Korean peninsula, killing everyone on board. 31 U.S. servicemen died that day. And that incensed President Nixon. There's a lot of talk of retaliation, bombing North Korean airfields, naval blockade, seizing North Korean vessels at sea. There's a lot of discussion. In the end, nothing is done. And throughout the course of the year, in August, North Korea shoots down a U.S. helicopter along the demarcation line, along the border between the North and the South. There are three survivors. North Korea holds them as captives for 4 months and releases them in December only upon the official apology by the Nixon administration for the crime of having deliberately entered North Korean territory. In the meantime, in October, North Korean patrol guards ambush and shoot and kill 4 U.S. soldiers along the border. All this does not suggest to me that North Korea is crazy or going berserk. It suggests to me that North Korea probably read the strategic environment correctly, that the U.S. would be unlikely to retaliate in any kind of major fashion, and North Korea was putting pressure on the United States and on South Korea. Well, I think that pattern would be played out later on in the mid-2000s when, for the Bush administration, the war in Iraq really turned sour. North Korea, you know, resorted to, well, its first nuclear test, long-range missile test in 2006, and got a lot of concessions from the Bush administration, despite all the rhetoric of acts of evil and President Bush saying, you know, things like, "I loathe Kim Jong-il." In the end, even someone who was as ideologically opposed to the North Korean leadership, after North Korea escalated by conducting its first nuclear test, did a complete turnaround and gave North Korea all kinds of concessions. The U.S. returned to nuclear negotiations. The U.S. even, I have to say, engaged in money laundering criminal activity, that is, by agreeing to have North Korea's $25 million in that bank, Banco Delta Asia in Macau, wired to the New York Federal Reserve, and then resending it sending it to a small bank in Vladivostok for North Korea to claim, as North Korea insisted, thus showing the world that North Korea's money is not dirty money. That's the kind of concession that the Bush administration made. The U.S. asked China, can we have the money transferred to a major Chinese bank, and then can you wire it to North Korea? And the Chinese said, no, thank you, we don't want to touch that. And the U.S. said, okay, then we'll do it. Not willingly, but that's what happened. And then the Bush administration resumed food aid and also ultimately took North Korea off the list of state sponsors of terrorism. These are key concessions. What did North Korea do? Give up its nukes? I don't think so. So North Korea is very clever. And when I look at the scorecard, shall we say, on nuclear diplomacy vis-a-vis North Korea over the past 25 years, North Korea has certainly not denuclearized. North Korea has expanded and it's been, advancing its nuclear weapons capabilities and missile capabilities. In the meantime, in return for repeated lies of denuclearization, North Korea has reaped, I would say, at least $20 billion worth of goods from China, from South Korea, from the United States. The United States alone gave North Korea between 1998 and 2005, so that period would overlap with both the Bush and Clinton administrations, on the record, according to the Congressional Research Service, $1.3 billion worth of virtually unconditional aid, food and energy assistance. Now you're thinking $1.3 billion is not that big a sum, even for a country like North Korea, but let me try to put that in context. In the late 90s, North Korea was undergoing a famine. North Korea's total exports for 1999 and 2000 was about $500 million each per year. $500 million, $500 million in total export earnings. It's tiny. It's really puny. So to give North Korea hundreds of millions of dollars in aid, as the U.S. and its allies, and China, of course, did, throughout that period, up to the present, why on earth would North Korea then give up its nuclear weapons? If it didn't have nukes, if North Korea were not a political factor, why would the world's biggest powers continue to give so generously to North Korea? So, I think we really need a new approach. And, I don't buy the view that North Korea is a child prone to throwing a temper tantrum. That's what Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said after North Korea's second nuclear test on May 25th, 2009, which just happened to be Memorial Day in the United States. North Korea really likes to do such things on a major holiday, American holiday, to rub it in, to make the point. And Hillary Clinton said, North Korea is like a child, we should just ignore it and not reward it by giving it attention. While I understand the sentiment behind that statement, it's kind of self-defeating to truly subscribe to that view, because North Korea is not a child. It is really a growing threat, and it seems to know what it's doing.
So let's. You've talked a good amount about mostly the U.S.-North Korea sort of dynamic, with little bits of China and kind of the role that plays. But I want to bring it to some issues I think that other people will also be interested in, about the bilateral relationship between North Korea and South Korea. I mean, obviously with the President Park administration, which came in, I guess it was 2 years ago now that the
2013.
So the Park administration has been in for a couple of years. It was the end of the so-called Sunshine Policy, where South Korea was going to be more friendly to North Korea in an attempt to get them to change, which obviously the sinking of the Cheonan, basically ended that. So I'm curious, for this politics in South Korea, is it a variable that Americans or any other policymakers should evaluate when looking at North Korea policy?
Let me go back to 2010, North Korea's two key provocations that year, which were a bit unusual in that it was the first time when North Korea shelled an inhabited island in November 2010. It was the first time that North Korea actually fired into South Korean territory in many, many years. And the sinking of the South Korean Navy ship, the Cheonan, in March 2010 was also an unusual and highly provocative act. Why? Why did North Korea do those things? Well, no one knows for sure, but we know that 2010 was a very important year for the current North Korean leader. It's his coming out year. In 2010, Kim Jong-un was mentioned for the first time by the North Korean government agency by the North Korean Central News Agency officially for the first time. Kim Jong-un, that name was mentioned for the first time within North Korea in late September 2010. And then Kim Jong-un revealed himself, made his, I guess, debut on the international stage on the occasion of the anniversary of the founding of the Party Founding Day, which is a major national holiday in North Korea, October 10th. So on October 10th, 2010, Kim Jong-un showed his face to the world by standing next to his father, who was still living at the time, Kim Jong-il, and on the reviewing stand, watching a military parade celebrating North Korea's Party Founding Day that day. And North Korea invited, I think, 200 or so journalists, foreign journalists, CNN and so forth, major media outlets were there on the scene covering this spectacle, covering Kim Jong-un. All interest was on Kim Jong-un. Now, what does that have to do with the provocations? Even in the early 80s, when Kim Jong-il was officially revealed as the heir apparent, North Korea resorted to major provocations. For example, in 1983, North Korean agents planted a bomb for the visiting South Korean president at the Martyrs Mausoleum in Burma, in Rangoon. And that bomb went off. The South Korean president had not yet arrived on the scene when the bomb went off, but it killed 17 high-ranking South Korean officials who were already on the scene, including the foreign minister. That, I think most people agree, was an act to bolster Kim Jong-il's non-existing military credentials as a brilliant general, as a brilliant strategist. So that was a risky attempt, an act of terrorism, in effect, to beef up the princeling's non-existent revolutionary credentials. Likewise, I see the two provocations in 2010, the coming out year for Kim Jong-un, as linked to North Korea's effort to bolster Kim Jong-un's, the third generational leaders, the future leaders' non-existing military credentials. So, although it's quite perverse, there is an element, a stream of rationality to what North Korea does. And, mind you, the attack on the South Korean Navy ship was an attack against the South Korean military, not on civilians. And the bombing of the island in November that year, in 2010, was, it's very impolite to say so, but I'll say it, it was a limited attack on a marginal fishing village, a small island. It was not as if North Korea dropped a bomb on downtown Seoul or blew up the Blue House, the presidential mansion, or the National Assembly or anything like that. That would be an act of war, probably. South Korea would probably have retaliated in a major way. So it seems North Korea just knows how to pinprick. North Korea knows how far to push the envelope and gets away with murder. So I think, North Korea has always been the party wielding the proverbial carrot and stick against South Korea and the United States. North Korea sees itself as the proactive party controlling its bigger foes, not the other way around. We see North Korea as an asinine creature, a donkey to be tamed. Give them money, give them some carrots, act strong, do a show of force, they'll listen to us. That's the way we tend to view North Korea. And it's kind of a patronizing view because, yes, they're very small and backward, but they do not just react to external stimuli. They're very crafty. And I think historically, it's really been North Korea calling the shots. It's been North Korea resorting to periodic military provocations against U.S. personnel and U.S. Installations in the South and against South Korean military and civilian population. North Korea has killed hundreds of South Koreans and dozens of Americans since the armistice of 1953. And they've taken a hit as well. Many North Korean soldiers have been killed in the meantime. But, it's a regime that places little value on human life. The threshold for pain is much higher in North Korea. And that's a basic internal dynamic in the Korean Peninsula that does not favor South Korea, which is a democracy. The leadership is accountable to public opinion, whereas the North Korean regime, if there is a skirmish and North Korea incurs, say, 5,000 casualties, that would be huge in the South. I think the public will be against continued escalation. In the North, it's business as usual. Kim Jong-un will not flinch if 10,000 of his soldiers are killed in round one. South Korea will not even contemplate going to round two if South Koreans were to take that kind of, you know, huge casualty. So it's an internal dynamic that favors North Korea. South Korea, despite all its rhetoric of bellicosity in the wake of the shelling of Yeonpyeongdo in November 2010. So North Korea, you know, does something like that again. Okay, South Korea will probably shoot back. What if North Korea shoots back? South Korea may or may not shoot back. What if it's a third time? I really doubt that the South Korean public has the appetite to continue to escalate in that fashion, tit for tat. The South Korean president serves a single five-year term. And although some might say, thank God, it's just 5 years, it's, you know, it's kind of short. But this does not favor South Korea because, you know, elected leaders come and go via elections. They have a definite term limit. And that means toward the second half of their presidency, and this is also true of American presidents, I think, too, there's a greater political desire, compelling need to carve out some kind of a legacy on North Korea policy, especially for the South Korean president. So there's gambling. There is a greater willingness to give North Korea even more concessions in the hope that would might lead to some kind of a diplomatic breakthrough. And I would say North Korea is keenly attuned to that kind of vulnerability on the part of the South Korean government.
So we've talked, I think, about every major regional actor that has a sort of a place in this drama, with the exception of one, and that would be the island just off the southern coast of South Korea, which is, of course, our friends Japan. Now, I know we've talked about this extensively, about, you know, the cross-strait relationship and the sort of the U.S. as the hub and spoke between Japan and South Korea. But I was wondering if you could walk people through who aren't as familiar with the dynamics as you are about what the key issues are between South Korea and Japan, since on the logical end, as both as two very developed democracies that are so close to each other that both see North Korea as a very serious, if not existential, threat, what the relationship dynamic is between the two of them and where you see that going, particularly with all the changes Japan has made in security policy over the past, I guess now it's been about a year.
If you look at the post-45 era, now 70 years, Japan has transformed itself during those seven decades into a model of peace and democracy, a very generous aid-giving nation, really a first-class industrialized democracy. If you look at the 70 years before that landmark dividing line, 1945, there are at least four major wars started by Japan, going back to the late 19th century, that took place in and around the Korean Peninsula. And ultimately, in the wake of Japan's serial victories over China in 1895, against Russia in 1905, and then the Second Sino-Japanese War in the 1930s, and ultimately the Pacific War against the United States, Japan, as the revisionist power par excellence in the region, swallowed up Korea. Japan colonized Korea from 1910 to 1945, but really Japan started its dominant position, its repressive policy against Korea in 1905 in the aftermath of victory over Russia, when all other foreign legations, foreign countries, basically severed diplomatic relations with Korea, and Korea became Japan's protectorate. Why do I mention this? Well, first, to underscore the geopolitical strategic importance of the Korean Peninsula. It's a hotspot. There's been historically international rivalry for the control over Korea. Second, to emphasize the continuing ambivalence bordering on hostility on the part of the Koreans against Japan, because Japan's colonial rule for 40 years, formerly 35, but really 40 years of repression, was extreme. There are some uniquely atrocious, cruel aspects of Japanese colonial policy in Korea. And that memory still lingers in both North Korea and South Korea. So South Korea-Japan relations have been tense historically, even in the post-45 era. The two countries only normalized diplomatic relations in 1965 upon the urging by the United States, and the U.S. has been playing this role of intermediary or peacemaker between its two dependent democratic allies, South Korea and Japan, for many decades now. And today, under the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe administration, Japan has, I would suggest, done and said things that seem to whitewash Japan's past crimes against Koreans, Chinese, Americans, and so forth, and other countries throughout the Asia Pacific. And that does not play very well within South Korea. So it's no secret that Japan-South Korea relations over the past 2.5 years or 3.5 years have been very tense, filled with tension. And the leaders of Japan and South Korea just a few days ago held their first bilateral meeting in 3.5 years. This is not normal, you know, for Japan and South Korea are basically tacit allies. You know, they do not have an alliance treaty between themselves, but they are, both countries are tied to the U.S.-led security structure in Northeast Asia. And both countries depend on the United States for security. So the tension, when things get bad between Japan and South Korea, the United States finds itself somewhat exasperated because there are bigger issues from the U.S. perspective. There are bigger, more pressing issues, China's growing aggression, assertiveness, and North Korea's growing military threat, security threat. These are the key challenges for the United States in the region, and when Japan and South Korea are bickering, it only helps the other side, China and North Korea. One key issue these days is the prospect for military operations by the Japanese self-defense forces in case of war in North Korea, regime collapse, an instability situation, you know, a civil war or some kind of an insurrection within North Korea. Would that call for intervention, military intervention by the U.S. troops in South Korea and the South Korean troops, perhaps the Chinese troops, if North Korea were on the brink of regime collapse, leading to a humanitarian crisis? In terms of the provision of aid, food, you know, water, medicine, clothing, and transporting people, refugees, and so forth, would there be a role for the Japanese maritime self-defense forces? South Korea's position is no, and only upon the official approval of the South Korean state could Japanese do anything in and around the Korean Peninsula, the Japanese military, that is. Japan's position is slightly different. No country has fully recognized South Korean sovereignty over the entire Korean Peninsula. South Korea denies North Korea as a de jure state, although it's a de facto state, and vice versa. North Korea regards South Korea not as a state, but as a renegade province. So there's an element of fiction here within the internal Korean dynamic in that neither recognizes the other as a real state. But, you know, the two countries, North and South, joined the UN, became official UN member states in 1991. And I think the prevailing view around the world is, yes, we have two states in the Korean Peninsula. So while South Korea assumes automatic control and jurisdictional sovereignty over North Korea if the regime collapses, that's not exactly how others feel about it. Although most of the world feels that South Korea is the more legitimate and proper Korean state on the Korean Peninsula. Will there be an occasion for military cooperation and participation, even in humanitarian missions and perhaps even combat operations by the Japanese military in the Korean Peninsula in the future? My personal view is yes, and that would be good for all concerned, the United States, South Korea, and for Japan too. You know, no country is an altruistic organization. If Japan wants to, and I think Japan does, to participate in military operations in case there's a contingency situation in North Korea, it will be out of its own self-interest. Japan has a strong interest in preventing the formation of a hostile power in the Korean Peninsula. So even in the Korean War, in the early phase of the war in the fall of 1950, the United States, as the U.S. was scrambling to galvanize the international community to fend off the invading North Korean troops, North Korea's invasion of the South in the fall of 1950, whom did the U.S. turn to in looking for allies in the region, Japan. Why? Because even in defeat, even during those post-45, you know, those difficult lean years in the immediate aftermath of the end of the war and Japan's surrender, Japan still was the most advanced country in East Asia. Japanese naval power, Japanese naval know-how was still the best in East Asia, specifically on the point of minesweeping. So it was all hush-hush and done under the rug. No one really came out and admitted it. But the United States actually used former sailors of the Imperial Navy in combat operations between early October and mid-December in 1950. Over 1,000 Japanese sailors participated in minesweeping operations in what we would say is North Korean territory, above the 38th parallel, on both the east and the west of the Korean Peninsula. And Japanese troops were killed as well. A couple of Japanese LST vessels were blown up by North Korea. I think about 50 Japanese were killed in these combat operations. And that was very controversial because the other side, after China entered the war, the Soviet Union, China, and North Korea criticized Japanese troops participating in the war and threatened to escalate. Therefore, the United States, I think on December 12, 1950, made the decision to send all Japanese troops back home from the Korean Peninsula. But, you know, during those brief couple of months, the Japanese troops played a major role in minesweeping operations and also in the transportation of prisoners of war and also dead soldiers. So there's a strategic asset there in Japan today, immeasurably more capable in such operations today than in 1950. So that's a strategic asset that will not be forgotten when there's a contingency in the Korean Peninsula, and I think it will be in South Korea's interest to tap into that potentially great resource in the Japanese military. Vice Admiral Thomas, Robert Thomas, about a year ago in late 2014, in an interview, pretty much said that he would welcome Japanese participation, especially in the early phase of war, and he mentioned minesweeping. And he said, would South Korea welcome it? And he thought South Korea would, under the exigencies of a contingency. And I think that's only natural. And although for various political reasons, you know, South Korea and others may not come out and say so explicitly, I think that's probably the operating guideline. It should be for South Korea and for Japan.
Well, it's good to know that people are thinking about these kind of contingencies, and hopefully we won't have to test whether that'll be the case, at least hopefully not in the near future. We'll wrap this up. Tell us a little bit about what you're working on and what you're reading, and if people are interested in diving more into this very complex and very rich topic that we've talked about today. So what are you reading? What are you writing? And what things do you think people should know about?
I'm working on a book, and it has the tentative title. It's a little catchy, maybe a bit silly, The Pyongyang Playbook. The Pyongyang Playbook, North Korea's Revolutionary Strategy. And my premise is North Korea, again, is very calculating, knows in its own mind what it's doing, is very careful, and in the long-term view, North Korea seeks to complete the communist revolution, meaning communize the entire Korean Peninsula. And when someone hears that, you know, you're probably thinking, oh, that's absurd, because South Korea is such a bigger economy, South Korea is so powerful, even its military alone could probably fight North Korea to a draw or prevail over North Korea. But in the end, you know, the goal in sports is to win, and until you play the game, you can't really say for sure which side will win. Even if it's a superior team, the inferior team always has a fighting chance, you know, a one-punch, you know, knockout chance. That's why you play the game, and therein lies, you know, the fascination, the excitement. In the real world, in international politics, the objective is not to play that game. And how do you avert that game, having to play that game? By overwhelming military superiority. That's deterrence. For North Korea, the only way to ensure its long-term survival is really to unite South Korea with its own system. How do you do that? Obviously, you can't do it on equal terms. You have to obliterate the South Korean system. How do you achieve that? You build up enough nuclear long-range missile capabilities, threat capability, to get the U.S. troops out of South Korea. You form a peace treaty with the United States, as North Korea always insists on demands. Then the presence of U.S. troops in South Korea will come under question. Why are they there? Americans will be asking that question. That's how you get the troops out. That would indicate a slight drop in the strength of the alliance between the U.S. and South Korea if the troops are not there physically. It's not so much how many people are there. It's the fact that U.S. troops are there physically in South Korea standing in harm's way, meaning if North Korea does anything and you kill American soldiers, we will march right into Pyongyang and end your system. That has held a peace, de facto peace, over the past six decades. If that dynamic is removed, then North Korea is freer to really pester South Korea. And in time, North Korea may resort to some kind of a blitzkrieg kind of attack, inflict a lot of damage on Seoul, which is quite vulnerable, of course. And again, going back to the pain threshold, I believe that if North Korea were to start something and South Korea were to fight back, in the end, South Korea would probably resort to a compromise rather than risk, you know, millions of people dying in a war against North Korea. So that's probably, from a rational perspective, what North Korea is trying to achieve over the long term, completing the revolution, communizing South Korea, and there are key steps along the way that North Korea needs to, you know, cross. So I'm sort of trying to analyze North Korea from, I guess in my own mind at least, from the North Korean perspective of what its long-term strategic goals are. And I have a couple of short pieces referring to this, the Pyongyang Playbook in Foreign Affairs, and then a sequel to it from September this year, Pyongyang's or North Korea's Next Dare, also in Foreign Affairs, for any of your listeners who may be interested.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time, and we look forward to getting a chance to read that book when it gets released. So thank you very much. We appreciate having you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.